When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ding dong.
Hi.
Come in, come in. Make yourselves at home, warm yourselves. And what a magnificent head.
What?
Superb head.
We can't go on meeting like this.
What shall we do?
Pull to open.
Pull to open.
Yes, and what do you do?
My followers will rise in their myriad.
I doubt it.
It's horrible.
And crude could lead to a brain malfunction. That spells danger.
What's that supposed to mean?
Write the blue touch paper and stand clear.
Here come the drums!
Hello and welcome to Pull to Open, a show that has returned to take its rightful place as ruler of all Doctor Who podcasts thanks to its ingenious idea of examining every episode of Doctor Who in random order. I, Pete Paschal, am a podcaster of the first rank. What are you?
And I'm Chris Taylor, and I just came over for some wine. Kind of a stormy night out there, and I thought maybe it might be nice and dry in here. But yes, we're just a couple of inventors, a couple of scientists, a couple of neurologists hanging out in a castle, or a couple of Doctor Who fans who love to go through the show in entirely random order, which is what this podcast is, we should probably mention. We get super random with it, with our intros. I love that.
I mentioned the randomness. It's an ingenious idea that only podcasters of the first rank could have come up with, of course.
Very, very true.
All things that Chris mentioned, in addition to occasional megalomaniacs here.
That's
on
right.
This podcast, because we have the power of being everywhere, and all at once, on all the platforms. But before we get to the platforms, I think I should go over where we have already been on this journey. So previously on Pull to Open, we had a recent random journey through a lot of different points in the show. So we were a few stories ago at a dream world, the dream world of Amy's Choice.
Yes, an episode that turned out to exist only in the brains of the Doctor and his companions.
That's right.
Foreshadowing.
That's correct. There was there was a lot of dreaming going on and a lot of choosing, and it happened. And then we chose to go somewhere else, but the randomizer chose for us what that would be, and that was, of course, Earth's nearest neighbor, our own satellite, the moon, but in the year 2070, where there was a little station there that controlled the weather, and then if you could somehow take it over, you could destroy the Earth. You'd think they'd put some security on that place.
You'd think.
But less of that was really going on, and so the Cybermen found their way in and then found their way out when that Gravitron was turned on them. So
we're recapping now in Previously On. But yes, the moon base. The moon base, we should also mention, had a big old chemistry lab in it. And again, that might be foreshadowing.
True. And then we jumped back in our time ship and went forward in time again, this time to the far future of, I think it was the 42nd century, which coincides with the title of that one, which was 42, Doctor Who's Foray into Real-Time Storytelling.
Written by Chris Chibnall, who would later invent and recreate and blast open Doctor Who canon with The Timeless Child.
Right. Something that served as the basis for that storyline, of course, is actually where we ended up to next. Today, we have come to Season 13, Serial 5, The Brain of Morbius.
That's right. It's time to get brainy with it. Do we have any other brains in Doctor Who titles? Do we have brain bingo yet?
No. But do you count mind? Because we did the Mind of Evil.
Oh, yeah. No, not counting mind, just pure brain.
Brain. This is brain. What is brain?
What is brain?
Spock's brain fans reference the
I was going to reference
why are we not
I was going to reference Spock's brain. While you look in the codex, I'll just tell the listeners about my issue with Spock's brain, which was I found the most terrifying episode of Star Trek when I was a kid.
Because it removed brains?
Because it removed brains. I had a super big issue with that. And also with the fact that Spock's brain isn't quite fixed at the end of it. And it was funny growing up and discovering years later that Spock's brain is renowned as sort of the worst episode of Star Trek. And it feels like nice revenge against this thing that terrified me. But yes, I'd never been to the brain of Morbius. And I do have a thing about brains. It is a particular terror of mine, partly because of Spock's brain. So is this it?
Wow.
Is this it?
Is the one Doctor Who title that has an actual brain in it?
Brain bingo, yeah. Ladies and gentle beings. Brain bingo.
We also have smaller cards.
We also have Sisterhood of Khan bingo.
Yeah.
And we almost have Philip Madoc bingo because we've done the Crotons and the War Games.
That's right. And I think he's in one more. I think
he's in Krull.
Power of Krull, right.
Power of Krull.
So you're good. So we still got one more for him. By the way, why is my War Games poster up here for the Brain of Morbius? Well, because we just said it. How many posters do I have that have Phil Madoc on it? It's only this one. And you win the prize of pull to open poster bingo. It's not a bingo, but it's something like that. Way to go, Phil.
Well, yes, we do like to play games here on Pull to Open. And we are playing bingo as we go through the random journey. But there is another game that we're playing.
Oh, is that the Humoji Challenge?
It might be, and before we get to it, I'll just prevaricate a little bit by saying if you're on YouTube, you can become a true companion of this podcast. You can be our very own Sarah Jane, and for just $7.99, you can be that, or you can contribute a little bit more and be a Viscount. That's right, the Viscount Banger, our highest rating. Contributing to that level, you get to be such a big brain in our eyes that your brain will actually appear between our two brains. that's right. You can pop up and join our podcast.
Well, remember, if you're a true companion, the thing you're going to affect most is our hearts. Of course.
All four of them.
We'll forever be indebted to you. And we will also ensure that you get the podcast a day early. So
that's right.
If you join at that level, you get it on Fridays, ladies and gentlemen. So that would be a companion away.
Really, really brainy thing to do. But not a brainy thing to do is to submit myself to torture every week, like I've been stuck in a plastic brain case. And yeah, here we go with the Humoji Challenge, which for some reason, I'm always the victim.
So I don't know why how that worked. I think it's because I might have the passwords to the Google account. So we'll just go with that one.
Yes. You, by the way, submit your torture attempt in the form of emoji describing a Doctor Who story in your review. I'll write that again just to stall for more time.
The best place to leave that is a review on Apple Podcasts or any of the other podcast apps where you can leave a review. And we will challenge Chris with your Humoji on a future episode of Pull to Open, just as we're doing now from this Humoji submitted by Mary Berry. This is the second in a series, second and final from a Mary Berry. And it is four emojis. So are you ready, sir, to hear this Humoji challenge?
Yes. And once again, all Doctor Who story titles have fled from my brain. And now I'm thinking about Mary Berry and, you know, what she's got cooking up.
Well, there are no brains or berries, I think, in this one. But
same.
It does have, as the first emoji, a couple of people, it looks like, with a pink heart between them.
Okay. So
there are people with a heart between them.
Yeah.
And then the second one is the goblin, the red goblin with sort of the dark mane.
Yes.
Okay. The third emoji, zombie. Fourth emoji, vampire. I'll drop this in the chat.
I'm chuckling quietly to myself because I have one guess. And if it's not that, then I'm all out of ideas. But I'm going to try one thing, and that's Is it Love and Monsters?
It's Love and Monsters! Wow! You really rebounded after last week's debacle.
I know. I'm sure, dear listener, if you're a regular Pull to Open listener, you were waiting for 5 minutes of, the title has fled my brain. All titles are, you know, and then I reference something from Star Trek or whatever. But no, I got that one. I love it. And it's particularly appropriate, I think, for Brain and Morbius, which was originally in Terrence Stick's mind going to be a vampire story and then end up being a take on Frankenstein. What better humoji for this episode?
Did the love emoji give it away?
Yeah, I was thinking, what else could that be? You know, love is not that common in Doctor Who titles. There may just be the one. It's not, you know, there's no the hand of love. There's no the love of Morbius. It's not.
It's funny. This has become an inventory of the interesting words that only appear once in titles. Yes. Nemesis, I think. Actually, I think that appears twice, doesn't it?
Silver Nemesis.
No, it's just the one. All right, now that I have the codex open, I feel like we've cracked open the dictionary and you just keep looking.
That's right.
Love and Monsters is the only one with the word love in the title. All right, well, way to go. Good job. I was very happy that I did not actually say the word love when I described the emoji, which would have kind of given it away. Yep. So thank you very much. Mary Berry, you can be just like that submitter and get your emoji not only read on air, but put into our codex. All of these live forever on the internet, which of course is forever.
Yes, and something else that's forever. Something else that's forever are Spotify polls. That's right, the poll to open feature. If you're on Spotify, pull from the bottom of the screen. Vote if you really wish right now on Brain of Morbius and what you think of it, according to our rating system, which we'll explain later. And those polls stay, they pretty much stay open forever, certainly for the lifetime of this podcast. We will get to the end of our random adventure, I think, before these polls actually close. There are literally thousands of days left to go. But we've got some results now. You can vote on every story that we do. And we have some results for the moon base, like the Cybermen themselves, it's sort of kind of they're coming in hot. I don't know what I'm thinking here. The fact that Cybermen would come in equal in a race because no one would want to be ahead of anyone else. Anyway, we've got a tie for the moon base between our two ratings.
That's right. They were the Dalek and the Professor Hayter. So
that's an right.
equal number of people went for each of those. So they both captured around 37.5% or so of the vote.
Yep.
And that
so far
is not too surprising. I mean, you know, it's a fairly mid episode is what I'm getting from this. It's like, okay, you know, and you could kind of go either way. Either this didn't really work or it did work. And generally, you know, it comes out with the ingredients that, you know, you could sort of make a solid case in either direction.
Yeah, and I'm going to say that I would say that that's all well and good. But no, I think my followers will rise in their millions and go right now to the Moonbase episode and vote on that and vote Professor Hayter. Vote Hayter in 24, people, at least when it comes to the Moonbase.
Guys, Daleks are supreme now and forever. So
why would Daleks vote for Cybermen? I don't know. Sorry.
It's one of those things. I think the Cybermen are going for the Dalek vote. That's what it is.
I'm just indulging in a smear campaign now. I'm sorry. It's politics have reached rock bottom here.
A little bit of a showing for Fixed Point in Time and Lady Cassandra. Mm-hmm. Each of those got a little bit of the vote. So it is it's not an Ogron and it's not a Viscount Banger. So it's not one of the worst or one of the best. That's at least something everyone agrees on.
Hey, we can all agree the moon base is not extremely good or bad. That's nice.
We can also agree we need a summary of the Brain of Morbius, the storyline in record time, which of course is how we always begin our commentaries with a little section we call TLDW, Too Long Didn't Watch TL Doctor Who. And Did I even say too long? I don't even think I did.
Yeah.
I think we all know what TL stands for.
Too long. Yeah, we all know. Timeline.
Right.
Yes. No. Too timeline. Doctor Who timeline. Yes. So it's my turn to summarize. And it's 30 seconds per Classic Who episode. So it's 2 minutes for the brain of Morbius. So my brain, which has just been stuck into its isolated plastic brain case with two trumpets on the front, will now have to remember and reveal this storyline while Pete keeps time.
That's correct.
Are you ready to keep time, sir? I know I'm flipping this back around on you.
Well, all this talk of brains is getting me hungry, so maybe we should take a break. But no! Might have let on a little too much in that comment, but no, we're going to get right to this. We're going to tax your brain, but only at a low GST percentage.
I don't know.
I was going somewhere with the tax analogy, but
it's a 70s story. Taxes were pretty high.
There you go. I was just thinking numbers. But the numbers that I'm on now are countdown, and those are in the pull to open summary of The Brain of Morbius. Beginning in 3, 2, 1, go.
At the planet Khan, there's a scientist called Solon, and he's got this guy called Kondo, who's his Igor, and he's basically Frankenstein. He's trying to put together this body, and he's just got the head of a mutt from a crashed spaceship, but it doesn't work, and he needs a real human head. Coincidentally enough, this Doctor and Sarah Jane just land on Khan. The Doctor's like, hey, the Time Lord's brought me here. I'm not going to do your dirty work. But then he ends up going in and meeting Solon. Solon's like, what a magnificent head. You'd be perfect for my brain casing. He drugs the Doctor, knocks him out with wine, but then the Doctor gets transported to the Sisterhood of Khan because they're here on this planet, and they want to kill the Doctor because they think he's in league with the Time Lords. Who's their Elixir? They used to be in league with the Time Lords, but there also used to be the guy called Mobius. Morbius, who is what Solon is trying to restore him, and now he's got Sarah Jane, but she tries to escape, but he and she goes to the Sisterhood and tries to stop them burning the Doctor, and the Doctor escapes because Sarah's loosened the thing, but then the Sisterhood blinds her, and then there's a lot of back and forth between Solon's castle and the Sisterhood, and what basically happens in the end is that Morbius puts the brain in the brain casing that he's prepared, but it on top of this sort of Frankenstein's monster of aliens that he's prepared, but the Doctor revives the flame from the Sisterhood, and then he goes back and he does battle with Morbius to distract him. Oh, he kills Solon with cyanide gas, basically. Igor dies fighting Morbius. But the Doctor has this battle, this mind-bending battle with Morbius, and they go back through the Doctor's previous lives. But the Doctor wins, and he takes off, leaving the Sisterhood with a flashbang in the TARDIS.
And that's time. It.
And I'm sure.
Look at that. You brought it home.
I'm sure in all that back and forth, I missed something that I'm not thinking about. But I think that's basically it, right?
I think you were light on Kondo.
On Kondo. Poor Kondo.
Otherwise, you kind of got it.
We're going to talk about Kondo. Let me tell you.
You had the mutt. You had all the brain case. You had the Morbius stuff, the Karn and the Sisterhood and all the things.
I didn't mention that the Sisterhood basically get torches and drive Morbius off the edge of a cliff.
Yeah,
which is like, you know, how obvious can we make our Frankenstein pastiche? let's double down. Let's make it more obvious. And which is also my problem with Kondo, by the way. Not only does he have a name that leads to all sorts of jokes about, like, you know, he's given up his arm for this Frankenstein's monster, and he needs another arm, so he needs a Kondo conversion. Yes. No. Dad jokes are plenty.
That is one pun you should have resisted.
Could not resist the pun, just like Solon. Could not resist a pun to Morbius about crowns and heads and brains. Anyway.
So I
it's going to be a lot of that. But Kondo, okay, I'll just get it out of the way now. Kondo, it's like they chose every single possible cliche of the of the Igor figure and said, let's just pile it on. The unibrow, the hunch, the missing arm, the way of talking, the Beauty and the Beast style, oh, me like pretty girl. And it's just, it's too much. And this is what, 1975 this was filmed?
76. Yeah.
They've got no excuse. Young Frankenstein.
Oh, no, it would have been filmed in 75 because it's
75. Like 76, yeah. Still no excuse. Young Frankenstein was the year before. How can you do a serious Igor figure after the tap dance routine in Young Frankenstein? I don't know.
Yeah,
sorry. Now,
this is a good point to start on because it is. It's like, is it is it too much homage to the original source material?
Mm.
And again, is it just homage? Like, in other words, if you depart too far, do you then run the risk of just not really having that resonance, or do you sort of do the you know, go through the motions, I guess, and use the canvas that already exists, and try to do it in a way that sort of makes sense with Doctor Who. So in other words, like I could see coming out on either side of this, which is because I kind of enjoyed that, seeing all the echoes of Frankenstein and seeing it sort of obvious this time, because I hadn't seen this since I was a kid. And obviously, even though it's like, yeah, obviously it's Frankenstein and you can get that even as a kid, this probably might have been my first time really seeing the story play out.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Rather than just seeing some aspect of that story in isolation, whether it's, you know, brains in jars or the just a monster that's assembled or the hunchback person, right?
Yeah.
So Kondo is probably, like you say, the ultimate part of like the absolute cliche. Because everything else might have a bit of a twist on it. Even the sisterhood's a little different because at least they're sort of telekinetic and a bit interesting. But Kondo, I think the only thing that I could say is kind of a good moment is when he sort of has that realization of his arm has been used in this creature.
Yeah.
And that kind of worked for me, even though he already has like a moment earlier where he wants to kill Solon and then can't decide if he's still working for him or not, it seems like.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? It's back and forth. I'm sorry. I didn't believe Kondo at any point. I think that's the problem. A lot of Brain and Morbius is a very funny story. This is what I'm discovering. I'll just say from the start that I did not see this as a kid. All I know about Brain and Morbius going into this, was the regenerations thing, you know, and spoil it a tiny bit, because I'll just say, if you are like me and you are going in fresh to Brain and Morbius, do not expect the how many lives do you have, Dr. Bit, to come up until the very end, because I was sort of like all the way through, I'm like, when's it going to happen? And then, yeah, so that does spoil it.
Doesn't happen. In fact, it's kind of, I know you don't watch on BritBox anymore, but I'm not sure what the thumbnails are anymore. But the thumbnail for the fourth episode is the mind-bending contest
on BritBox. Okay, I do not get thumbnails. I once again downloaded this from the Internet Archive, where it is available for free. The only downside of that being that you don't get subtitles, so I also have to download the transcript so I can follow along.
So what I really like about this story, though, just to stay on the themes for a bit, yes, it's a whole Frankenstein canvas, it's obvious, and what your taste on that, you know, may vary, but what I really like is how they weave it into the mythos of Doctor Who. And thematically, this story isn't just, you know, paying homage to Frankenstein. It's talking about mortality, immortality, recognizing when your time is up and when you artificially extend that time, what sort of the horrible consequences there can be. And I really like that. I mean, I think it works really well because it's, you know, you can even sort of make some meta comments about Doctor Who itself on this, because obviously, you know, it reboots itself all the time. There's a lot there in this story about regeneration and this sort of variant that the sisterhood does, which is just this elixir of life that just keeps them living forever, and what the downsides of all that is. So
it is. Really, it's so. it's very New Who-ish. And the thing I was going to say about coming to it fresh is it's very funny. Like, it feels New Who-ish in its funniness. Like, Tom Baker has so many good lines. Mm-hmm. He really is the star of the show here. He's in the top of his game, the prime of his Doctorhood. And he's just served so many good lines.
Did you have a favorite?
I love the bit where he gets teleported by the sisters, which, we'll go back to our teleportation discussion and whether it belongs in science fiction at some point. But he gets teleported and then he just sort of dismisses it with like, it's that's so quaint. Now, if you had a good pickup truck or forklift truck. Yes. Yeah. okay. I guess it's just sort of, he's mad in this. He's wonderfully mad.
Tom Baker recognized this as had some good jokes for him. I don't know if his favorite joke, which he's given interviews about, where he's outside in the pouring rain with Sarah and the door opens with Saul on there and he's like, any chance of a glass of water? And he thought that was really funny. I don't know. I thought that one was a little kind of a lead balloon, but I do love the end where Morbius comes out and the doctor just starts insulting him.
Yes.
It's not like it's just a potpourri would be a better name for you now. And what about Chop Suey, the Galactic Conqueror, you know?
Chop Suey. Yeah, that's a bit unfortunate, Sarah. But yes, no, so it's very New Who-ish. It's very funny. It deals with these big themes. It says it has interesting questions to ask about regeneration and living on. And even the question of like whether the doctor himself wants the eternal life that he appears to have been granted. That is sort of referenced here with the other, you know, the sort of timeless child incarnations, which we have to say, let's just say it up front, those were at the time absolutely 100% supposed to be incarnations of the Doctor.
Oh, wow. You want to get into this now? Screen. We're not saving this for later? Let's do it.
I mean, it's just case closed. So, I Hinchcliffe has said it. Yeah. Robert Holmes has said it. Yeah. So it's there. We don't have to get into it, but I want to say it at a high level, you know, that's why I think this is wonderfully New Who-ish. Except for the fact that, could you imagine if in Timeless Children, Chris Chibnall had inserted himself as a
right
as a former doctor?
Right.
That's what's going on here with both Hinchcliffe and Robert Holmes appearing as the former doctors.
Yeah,
and well, we gotta funny. Say it's the doctor well really liked facial hair.
Yeah, he was a big fan of beards in his you might call them negative incarnations. I mean, the doctor negative one, negative five, or whatever. I guess we'll just call them the Morbius doctors is what
the Morbius doctors. Yes. To.
So again, there's no disputing what you say, which is to say that they meant them to be previous incarnations of the doctor. And that was picked up on by Chibnall. All of that is just fact. But I think it bears some discussion of why this was sort of resolutely ignored for the longest time. And it's kind of interesting. I got to say, I've recommended these books before on the podcast, and it's the A History books, which have a lot of sort of essays about Doctor Who. But also one of them is their opening essay where they talk about Doctor Who's always had flexible canon. And even if you didn't think it was, and, you know, making these sort of big moves, whether it's the Morbius doctors or the follow-up or whatever, it's really been since the start, because the Daleks originally were just that one city and they were this sort of pathetic race. Mm-hmm. And then they just turned out to be super popular. So they decided to completely retcon who they were in season two. And they're Galactic Conquerors, and we'll sort of have some throwaway dialogue that maybe explains it or maybe doesn't. And they always just go for whatever's the good story. And it's of course what you should do. But then once you build up more and more things, I mean, we all kind of want this to happen in the same universe and we all kind of want it to make some sort of sense. So the fact that not just fans, but even sort of the creators of the show were, I don't want to say offended. I don't think it's the right word, but we're so put off by this idea even, or at least not excited by it, that William Hartnell might be not the first doctor, that they just decided, no, that's getting it wrong. We're going to have to interpret that differently because it's upsetting the quote unquote, the orthodoxy, right?
Right.
It's interesting, like to think about what the rules are of that. Because, well, they've always upset the orthodoxy. It just kind of depends on whose orthodoxy, how good the story is, and what you're sort of promising to lead people into, right? So, because you also have the same kind of backlash now with the Timeless Child.
Yes.
And that storyline.
Yeah, so, if you are feeling bad about Timeless Child still, definitely go back and watch Brain of Morbius, because yes, all of this has happened before. All of this shall happen again. This is a show that likes to mess with headcanon, your headcanon. And basically it's a show designed to spark your headcanon, I think is what we're learning here. Can you imagine sitting down for your tea time Doctor Who in the mid-70s? And you're watching the final episode of Brain of Morbius. No idea what's coming up. And all of a sudden, like, what? The Doctor has 8 new incarnations that I did. What?
Was the show on in the 50s and I didn't know?
Exactly. It's like they're trying to gaslight you. Like, oh, yeah, you remember that guy? Oh, and that Doctor kept us entertained during World War II. How many lives have you had, Doctor? So... and then it was never dealt with again, right? It just got shunted to the side. And I just love the idea that, you know, kids were like forever changed by that. It just fizzed in their heads for weeks. And yes, once they grew up and became serious fans, not like kid fans, but serious fans, like we must talk about canon. Then this sort of thing persisted, this line, this story, this ruse that those were actually previous incarnations of Morbius.
Right. And you kind of, you don't have to squint that hard to see that. Like,
because there is a Morbius on screen. So.
Yeah. So that said, the dialogue strongly implies they're the Doctor, because the voiceover as Morbius, he's saying like, how long have you lived? How far back do you go, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And they're showing these faces while he's saying that. Well, come on.
They're saying the faces. So it's kind of obvious. It's kind of obvious when you see it. It's kind of obvious because, you know, a creator's intent does matter. And, you know, but when you've got both Hinchcliffe and Bob Holmes saying, no, quite clearly, this was supposed to be. That was our intention. You know, I mean, yes, you could squint if you like and you do whatever you want. But no, the Doctor has had previous lives. And I think that it looks even better now looking back on it, because not because of that scene, but there's a bit of dialogue between the Doctor and the head of the Sisterhood. What's her name? The one who sounds like she's been smoking a million cigarettes. Mari. Yeah. She's been inhaling the smoky vapors from below the earth. But they have this conversation, but the Doctor says, no, you need death. You can't have eternal life. You shouldn't, we shouldn't synthesize this elixir. You could, but we shouldn't, because, without death, you have no progress. And it's what's interesting. Irony, extreme irony, especially in the context of Timeless Child, because the Doctor lives forever, basically, so far as we know. And I'm sure like there's sort of a ready-made end to Doctor Who, isn't there? That he's just the character is just this Aurora Boris, like in the very last show, you can just have him being shoved through a portal as a child.
And then,
so it's just a loop. So then the Doctor ends up being one big bootstrap paradox. Google it. I love it. But also, like, you see it again with the regeneration after regeneration, especially Capaldi, who did not want to change. He wanted to just end it. The Doctor can't end it. The Doctor just keeps going. So I think it really works within the larger theme that we're talking about here of immortality. But,
it does. I mean, if you wanted to be productive about it, and we've said on our podcast around Christmas about the toy maker statement and the giggle about how he made a jigsaw of the Doctor's history, and if you urge us to interpret that as retconning the retcon, which is of the Timeless Child, could you then fill in what these previous incarnations are in some other way? And just because he has some hidden memory of being someone else, does that necessarily mean he was? And I don't know. It's because it's tough because you
Shooty has explicitly said that he is an orphan, right? So that's
as far as he knows.
You can't use the jigsaw to retcon, like, because he wouldn't be that credulous if he thought it was something.
Maybe we go down this in some other way or whatever. Yeah. But I think there's a little too much. I mean, certainly with the 13 arc, there's probably a little too much to just neatly retcon it. So to your point, I think even if you wanted to do that, it's not very yes and. And I think going yes and maybe making something good of this again, which he didn't necessarily even originate, as we're seeing here in Brain of Morbius. There's interesting things to do, but I don't know if the orthodox view necessarily needs to go away entirely. I think there's ways to kind of layer them both on, and it's going to take some creativity to figure that out, but.
More than most, this is a show that you can headcanon however you want. You can build your own Frankenstein's monster of Doctor Who canon, right? You can make a jigsaw of your own history. I think the overall point here is I think that this is very New Who-ish, and it's wonderful and naughty and great dialogue and all of that. And it's just that's why, to bring it all the way back around to Kondo, why I had such a problem with that character. And we should say Terrence Dix did too, because the original idea here that Terrence Dix had, well, the original idea was that he wanted it to be about vampires, Terrence Dix loves vampires. We've been to State of Decay. So he would eventually get his wish, but here they said, no, let's do, something else. And he said, okay, Frankenstein in reverse, which was the original idea was there would be a spaceship crash and a robot would have to stick together bits of a human. So the robot would be the Dr. Frankenstein and the human would be the monster. Clever reversal, right? And they couldn't, they decided they couldn't afford to do a robot.
Right.
So that's why we got Kondo.
It's a little bit silly. I mean, I guess maybe they were burned by robot.
Yes.
The story where it was like that. It's a little hard to see that as being a credible monster, and it's maybe not the best design. Anyway, we'll get there when we get there. So, but again, it's classic Who, right? I mean, if you got a good enough story, we're gonna go with it. So maybe that's too bad. Again, I don't know. I do kind of didn't mind that Kondo sort of gets a spine at a couple different points in his sort of arc, if he has one. And that sort of arm's mine. I mean, I do like the body horror throughout this thing. And I think that's a key part of it, that you see the body part and you know who it belongs to.
Yes.
I think it's a good moment of visceral, like, oh, yeah, that's this is all kind of gross.
And maybe that's what upset Mary Whitehouse, because of course the other thing Brain of Morbius is famous for, it's kind of kickstarting the career of Mary Whitehouse, who wasn't as well known before this particular story when she started a major letter writing campaign to the BBC about how scary this was for kids.
Which I would counter. My daughter watched the whole thing with me. She's now 11, and she was fine with it. In fact, she thought Kondo was the best character. That was her favorite of all of it. So,
I mean, you just want to sit him down and give him a makeover. I get it. You want to just deal with that unibrow. Just pluck all his eyebrow hair. Like, start afresh there. I get it. And I should say, at the time, Mary Whitehouse was roundly dismissed and diminished. The Guardian had a whole letters page of people arguing against her, but thereby giving her more oxygen. But, whatever.
Right.
A newspaper called The Evening News did a survey of kids at a local primary school or whatever it was. They found that only 10% of children out of like 800 kids were at all scared by Brain of Morbius. So,
And you know what? Good for them. I mean,
yeah, if you're
a little scared, either turn it off, hide behind the sofa, or ask your mom and dad to give you some reassurance and context that chopped up monster isn't going to emerge from under your bed. So,
hey, being afraid of Spock's brain made me the man I am today.
Exactly.
Qualified neurosurgeon.
So the thing is, what I think this, I mean, this episode definitely holds your attention throughout. I think it's very well paced. There's a lot of interesting things going on, but the thing that holds it together isn't just Tom Baker. It's the character of Solon, of Philip Maddox. Yeah. I think he is unbelievably good in this. This is my favorite role of his in all of Doctor Who. He's only got like 3 or 4, but he is amazing. Solon is the evil mastermind that all evil masterminds should aspire to be. And he has this just beautifully kind of mostly understated intensity. And with those eyes, his eyes are like perfect mad genius. It's like you kind of think back to the War Games where he had the glasses on the whole time, right? It's like, oh yes, man, they really underused his eyes in that one.
They did. But what he does use in the War Games and here is, you're right, the soft voice. Like he can chew the scenery and swallow when he needs to. He just like, no, but yes, your other villain should take notes on how to chew scenery here. But he's also, it's got that quiet voice of authority where you sort of feel everyone in the room go quiet because they have to listen to him. It really works as the warlord, and it works here.
And he's given really good material because he's right away very creepy and off, even though he's sort of their patron and the benefactor that sort of takes Sarah and the Doctor in. And right away he starts talking about the Doctor's head. And like, oh, yes. but he also like he says it in a way that's, I'm a little bit self-aware of my own nuttiness, and I'm this. It's almost like a stamp collector who just saw, you know, the stamp with the upside down plane or something, right? Like they're just so excited, but they also know I'm the only person who's excited about this, and if I get too excited, everyone's going to think I'm a weirdo. So I need to clamp it down, but I can't really clamp it down entirely because I'm so excited.
Yeah, you sort of want a cut of Brain of Morbius where you hear a monologue from Solon's brain throughout all this, the way you sometimes hear Homer's brain in The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, shut up, brain. Stop talking, brain. You know, why are you saying that about his head, brain? Stop being weird. But yes, I just want to say for American audiences who may be coming to the Brain of Morbius the first time, and look a scan, so perhaps giggle at the scenes where he says magnificent head and superb head. In British culture, that doesn't mean the same thing. Okay, I'm just going to say that. I'm just going to leave it there. But yes, he's obsessed with heads. He also, so he's carving this massive image of Morbius for what reason? I don't know, because it's not like how's Morbius's brain in there.
Well, and it's also, like, if your whole thing is I'm supposed to be, like, I'm secretly bringing Morbius back, like, maybe don't give interviews to Morbius Magazine or whatever the hell else he's doing, you know? It's kind of like low profile. Maybe keep that bust of Morbius, you know, as a project down the road that you do, or keep it locked up with the brain, but maybe don't keep it in your main atrium when the sisterhood is calling anytime. Like, wait a minute.
Yeah, he's really not good at marketing and at avoiding spoilers. I mean, you know, talk about Doctor Who set leak. The Doctor himself snapped a grainy picture of that bust, and he's like, wait a second.
Well, I got to say, and then that's one of the weaker parts of the story. Like, it kind of doesn't make sense that the Doctor even trusts Solon a little bit after this point, when he's so clearly like the bad guy, and you think the Doctor would both trust his instincts, but not just his instincts, because after a certain point, like certainly after he's been drugged by Solon, you would be very disinclined to even go there or to take his word at anything, right? Because he seems to trust him when he diagnoses Sarah's blindness as permanent, which is a lie. And he drinks the wine, even though he's already got creepy vibes.
He drinks the wine. And now it's time to step into our Doctor Who alcohol corner, cocktail corner, for our regular feature on Is the Doctor a Lush? Because we talked a lot about this in Hartnell's stories, right? Because he accepts the mead and the Time Meddler, but he refuses all other offers of alcohol. In his Pertwee incarnation in Days of the Daleks, he's sort of pretending to be a wine connoisseur, you know, so he can have the really good wine. But now, by his fourth incarnation, or at least, you know, fourth incarnation of this particular go-around, he's hit the skids, man. He's just accepting wine from strange dudes in castles. And but then he's like, afterwards, like a true alcoholic, he's like, oh, never again. He's like, no, I'm not going to have more wine. I've had your hospitality once.
Well, the thing this scene does, it actually gets to show Sarah's smarts, because they very clearly show her pouring out the wine. Like, of course, like, which is exactly, you're kind of going, of course, why didn't you do that, doctor? And then she sort of fakes being drugged. So it's good. I mean, it's a decent episode for Sarah, even though she's blind through a good chunk of it. But, and she, I don't know if this is dumb or brave, but when she's blind and sort of wanders downstairs into the Morbius brain room and then tries to also wander back to the sisterhood, like, that's going to work because you can't see anything. And she doesn't even like get like a stick or something to kind of like help guide her.
Two things I'll say about Liz Sladen, who is of course awesome, love you Sarah Jane, you know, still best companion ever, no one will ever touch you. And she did, to show her classiness, she ad-libbed that line about, and the doctor says, I well, you know, Solon admires the doctor's head. Doctor says, I used to have this gray model. And Sarah says that she liked it. That was a Liz Sladen ad lib.
Mm.
A little classy shout out to John Pertwee. I love it.
Nice.
So that's nice. And also, she gets unfairly slandered because we hear at one point that her brain case is not big enough. For Morbius's brain. Now, it
no
is
one's ever
true.
Accused her of having a big head, Sarah Jane.
Oh, Sarah Jane, we do love you. But yeah, I could use your brain case anytime. I don't know why I said that. No, here's the thing. Women's brains are, 11% smaller than men's on average, but there is no functional difference otherwise, except that women have more connections between the hemispheres. Men to have one big fat pipe.
But I mean, he has to, like, here's the thing. I guess we could maybe talk a little bit about what exactly Solon's doing, right? Because isn't he going to just pull out the brain and then put Morbius's brain into the skull? Or
yes.
Right? So
apparently
you would need a decent sized head, even though, like, the brain looks giant, by the way, when it's in that case. It looks like
it does.
It's one of those things where the effects guys didn't quite get the memo that they needed a realistic size brain.
Okay, but, sidebar. I watched this with a friend of mine who's a mortician, and that's the first thing they noticed. That brain is way too big. And they told me that this is how you understand the size of your brain. You put your hands together like this. You can see this on Spotify or YouTube. Yep. And that's about the size of it. So, yeah. So maybe that does make sense. The giant head that he was carving of Morbius and the giant brain. Like, maybe Morbius was this sort of titanic figure.
Well, maybe it just expands in the liquid. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of. It sort of spreads out a little bit.
Like a sponge.
All the dendrites and stuff just kind of relaxes. And it just gets all mushy and it goes soft, as the doctor says. Because clearly, even though Morbius is a Time Lord of the first rank, I mean, we talked about the previous incarnations. We didn't talk much about the contest itself. It pretty clearly has gone soft, right? Because if the doctor, and again, maybe it's also because he's just freshly out or whatever. And the doctor's mind is pretty formidable, but it's like he's going, you know, literally head to head with the High Council, the Lord President or former, you know, like this dude who you would presume would be really, really good at this. And he doesn't do that well. So he's
The dude does have his brain in a brain casing that Solon tried to warn him about the side effects.
Static electricity.
Side effects may include
Doctor Who.
Whereas I love that he just sort of goes very briefly kind of Hippocratic Oath-ish for a bit. He's like, no, Morbius, I can't do this. What's he say? It's something like,
The static electricity is going to make it so that there's discharge and there'd be extreme pain. And essentially it wasn't suitable, which is why he abandoned the brain case. But yet it did work. Morbius seems to be completely fine.
Side effects may include severe pain, seizures, perhaps even madness. And then Morbius is like, no, I don't care. Put it on. And so I was like, okay.
Well, he was already mad, to be fair.
But yeah. He does, you know, in keeping with being a top neuroscientist, mention real areas of the brain, like Broca's area, which controls speech.
The science of this one, I mean, as goofy as it is and as silly Bride of Frankenstein it is, or it's more like Reanimator, I guess. It's like that kind of sort of science. But the cyanogen stuff is accurate. You know, like you can make cyanogen from the chemicals they're talking about. And yeah, it is toxic. So it's funny that that does also bring up, like, is Saul undead? You mentioned at the beginning that the cyanogen kills him, but like, it doesn't, it's never clear. He just sort of passes out and then you never see him again. So it's possible he was just knocked out. And it also is like, did the doctor, if they killed him, like the doctor and Sarah killed him, if that's the case.
Yeah. There's
I like
not
that they
been,
kill Return.
Yeah. Big finish. We'll surely do the Solon series. By the way, I was surprised to learn that Big Finish has done almost nothing with this. Like, I expected there to be Morbius. A whole Morbius box set of, like, you know, the old adventures of Morbius.
No, but there's been a novel too.
Mm-hmm.
There's a novel called Warmonger that I think goes into, I think it's young Morbius. So there's a little bit there. And so there's been some follow-up here, but to your point, I think you're right. That some of this stuff here has been a bit maybe underutilized in other media, because there is a lot of lore with the Time Lords and the Sisterhood of Karn that is introduced here. And then it's almost hard to believe, because this is pre-Deadly Assassin.
Yes.
That would come a year later. But this whole thing where they just go into it and right away the Sisterhood start talking about the Time Lords, and you realize you kind of get like, ooh. This is cool. This is serious. This is really big cosmos defining type stuff.
Yeah. Should we talk about that? Should we talk about the Sisterhood? Let's get into it, because I've done the Sisterhood of Khan entirely backwards. You know,
I see.
I, you know, well, not entirely backwards, because I guess that would be starting off with Magician's Apprentice and then going backwards.
Right.
But no, I encountered them for the first time in Night of the Doctor, and was all sort of excited about, I understand they're from Brave Morbius. And they give the Doctor this elixir, and I've had this headcanon theory for years that the elixir is what makes the New Who regenerations different. It's why the Doctor loses the no-claims bonus on his TARDIS by shooting out jets of flame. It's, you know, he's had too much elixir. So it's fascinating to find out that he has elixir in this.
Right.
They mentioned that it's sort of that the Time Lords always use the elixir, like it is somehow connected to all regeneration.
I don't know. It's unclear, right? Exactly what that means. I don't think they say that. What it seems to imply is that the Time Lords and the Sisterhood used to have some kind of alliance or agreement, and they were essentially friends. And what that gave the Time Lords the privilege of doing is using the elixir sometimes. And how they used it, I'm not sure. But the going theory is that it helps with regeneration crisis. So it's just a thing that they can used to sometimes turn to to sort of help with their medical science. That's the extent of it. Because it's never really mentioned again. And now, subsequently, we were just talking about the storyline that establishes that regeneration is actually from the Doctor, and that was something that was engineered into the Time Lords by Tektuan.
It's interesting. But let's talk about there's this whole crisis about the elixir has run out because the sacred flame is dying, which, first of all, makes this a very 70s Doctor Who energy crisis story.
But all you had to do is just wipe away some of the soot.
Yeah, so the Doctor throws down a firecracker? Is that what it is? He pulls out something from behind his ear. And
it's basically one of those easy light logs you get at Home Depot, I think.
And it's just carrying that around in his pocket.
Yeah, well, why wouldn't you?
Well, maybe he put it in the pocket where he should have put the Sonic.
Right.
Because we learn at one point of the story the Doctor's left the Sonic back in the TARDIS and because he's filling his pockets up with firecrackers. What is he, Ace? yeah, so anyway. So,
makes sense to me.
But it does somewhat diminish the sisterhood to be like, oh, you know, you stupid girls, that all that had to happen was this man just comes in and throws a firecracker down the pit and then your sacred flame is fine again, ladies. Let's also not talk about the shape of the sort of the weird alcove that they get the flame out of.
I don't know where your mind's going.
Oh, come on. It's kind of, it's more obvious than like the pit in the Sarlacc pit. This way too obvious in this one. They should probably blur it out.
Very feminine fire. Yeah. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think you're right in the criticism that the Doctor just comes in and it's just, I wiped away some soot, right? I wish there was a little more to it than that. Maybe it's a sonic screwdriver. Maybe it's something else. I mean, obviously they had to write it so that he didn't have the sonic later, which is kind of, I will say, another weak point, because it's just, yes, I get it. Sometimes he has the sonic, sometimes he doesn't work. We didn't have deadlock seals yet. Sometimes you just can't get out with the sonic, whether he has it or not. So you got to throw something in. But the fire should have been more, I'm using Time Lord science here to help with your thing and helping reestablish this thing, this flame, and hopefully rekindle some sort of alliance here. That should have been better. Because again, I think you're right, because it just kind of makes them look dumb. That said, I do like the portrayal of the sisterhood overall. I think this is their best outing, because in New Who, it's really more referencing it than seeing it. And they almost seem like cave dwellers in New Who. Whereas here, at least they have a building and they have some kind of religion. And it gets you excited to get your mind going. Like, well, what are they? Who are they? What's their civilization?
I really like their costumes. I've just got to say that while we're talking about their cave and their set. And that's clearly where all the money went. And it is, in fact, where the money went in this. It was all filmed in studio on videotape and looks better than that it has any right to do, given that it's on videotape.
Better than Chris Benrick.
Right? And their red and gold costumes look spectacular. Their whole cave system looks, you're right, much better than actual caves. My favorite fact about it, though, and it may be one of the most Doctor Who things ever, is that their set was decorated with plastic spoons they got from the BBC tea lady. Right?
Oh, isn't that sweet?
This is literally a show that's put together with like sticky tape and spoons.
I've never heard anything more British.
Right.
Just video tape on at the BBC studios using teaspoons.
Yeah. And there's that wonderful bit where they put the Doctor in the stake and they tried to set fire to him. His scarf did actually catch fire.
Yeah.
In the studio.
Apparently, there was a lot of danger. Like, basically, he really had to get out of there, and so there was a little smaller fire subsequently, which you can see on camera.
Yes.
So,
and depending on how much wine Tom had at lunch, he may have been way too flammable in that scene. That could have been very nasty. Now, by the way, he does, while I'm thinking of Tom Baker and wine, he sings that song. Do you know the song? Show me the way
sacred
to go home.
Sacred flame, sacred fire. No,
that's the banger remix by the Sisterhood of Khan versus Skillrex. He sings "Show Me the Way to." I had a little drink about an hour ago. Is, as every British person would know, a quote from the song "Show Me the Way to Go Home." I think it's a 30s song. "Show Me the Way to Go Home. I'm tired and I want to go to bed. I had a little drink about an hour ago and it's gone straight to my head." Which you could say it's another head/brain pun that he's about to say it, but he doesn't say it.
Okay.
So yes, it's a song by a drunk. It doesn't seem to have traveled the world, apparently. But like that's the narrative perspective.
Nice. One other thing I really liked about the Sisterhood is their dance moves. I thought it was They're moving surprisingly well. Now, again, everyone's kind of doing the same movements, but they're all doing it really well. And there's enough there that, I don't know, I liked it. It was pretty cool. Apparently, they did have at least one professional dancer.
Yes.
To train everybody. And they cast the sisterhood, the extras, essentially, all based on their dancing ability, because they knew they had to do this move a few times. And they do a great job. It's like, okay.
I love that. And it was a cost-saving measure. It was like, yeah, just get one or two dancers, and everyone else copy them. Yeah. But the extras almost did too well, because it kind of makes Liz Sladen stand out as obviously not a sister when she's sort of not really dancing very well in her pink blanket. Right. I should say not red. It's so obvious. So that's an issue. But yeah, it looks amazing. I love the sisterhood. Like, this is it's a good story. None of my criticisms I want to take away from that. It's a really solid mid-70s Hinchcliffe era, you know, scary gothic, but also funny Doctor Who.
The last note I'll make about the set, though, is Solon's, speaking of 70s, he's got some 70s flower petals on one of his doors. Did you see that? It looks like it's like blue with the white flower petals when Sarah goes through a couple times.
It just
looks like the mystery. So it's one of the only things in the show that really took me out of it.
Interesting.
Where he's got some sort of 70s changing room somewhere in his castle. And it's like, okay.
That's weird. The only thing I know about that set is that it was inspired by Gaudi, that was the instruction given to the set designer. Like, you know, the Barcelona architect Gaudi, if you've seen any of his stuff, it's sort of famously sort of very wibbly wobbly.
Mm. What do you think about the Morbius monster overall?
Still confused as to why it was necessary at all. Given that, you know, you could just insert, you know, the brain in the next humanoid to pass along. Why, by the way, why did Solon never kidnap her sister? And I guess well, brain case is too small.
But he does say he's designed this body, certainly from the body parts of the people who are in the spaceships and stuff, but he's designed it to be formidable.
Yes.
So he does have, he's got one hand for actual hand stuff, and he's got a big claw.
And he's got a claw.
He's got a massive claw. He can resist the cyanogen because of the lungs. He's got all, like, basically it's designed this body to be powerful. So
we talked about claws in the moon base with the ill-advised cyber claw and the claw that comes in at the end from the Macrotera.
Oh, you mean like the three-fingered claws?
Yeah. Just sort of, you know, and I think this is another example of like how claws must have been scarier in the 60s and 70s than they are now, and they just sort of had to be inserted in everything.
Well, Kondo's claw is kind of scary. I mean, you know, you can really take someone's head off with that thing called Kondo.
There are claws, by the way. Okay, so I kind of like the body. It's kind of weird and wonderful and iconic. But it does also, talking of claws, reminds me, we should talk about the Terrence Dicks stage play that he just wholesale lifted a lot of this script from. First of all, it takes a place on a planet called Khan.
Oh, okay.
This is the Doctor Who and the Seven Keys of whatever it's called.
Oh, Seven Keys to Doomsday.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
So it's set on a planet called Khan, and it basically has the mind-bending contest at the end. So that's, if you're watching Brain of Morbius and thinking, hey, that's a bit Deus Ex Machina, you know, this machine that we've never seen before suddenly gets used to defeat Morbius. That's why it's Deus Ex Machina. He was just sort of stuck for an ending. He's like, I guess I'll use this machine from my stage play. No one's seen it.
That was he had his own ChatGPT, which was himself back then in the 70s. You do this for me.
Yes.
Myself.
Yes, yeah. he had a brain of Terrence Dicks in a jar.
Well, I mean, you know, the best writers steal. No, wait. Good writers steal. No, the good writers imitate.
Copy.
The best writers steal.
Best writers steal, from himself.
The absolute outstanding writers steal from themselves. And we see this with Douglas Adams time and time again.
It's just true.
Comes back to sort of the same themes and same plot devices and absolute genius.
Speaking of stealing from it, do you think the Doctor's brief mention at the end, where he has this sort of kind of brief sort of almost regeneration sickness-like moment where he just sits up and starts talking weird about food, and he says the word no custard. Now, do you think Moffat took his inspiration from that for the 11th hour, fish fingers and custard? That,
but yeah, even if he didn't, I think he might have done so unconsciously.
Yeah,
it might have been an idea that got lodged in his brain.
Hey! Yeah, and he says something about apricots as well. Like, it's a list of food, right. And you got to think that Moffat, the old school fan, is looking at that and thinking, hey, that's great. That's great for a regeneration.
Yeah, he says nectar and then apricots and then custard. Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
All right, that is a good cue for us to go right to some questions. And those are, of course, the four questions to Doomsday. First question, why did the randomizer take us here?
Well, coming straight here from 42, I have to note that 42 is also fundamentally a story about an energy crisis, just like the Sisterhood's energy crisis. Other than that, the randomizer likes the claw. It's featuring the claw a lot in Brains.
From the moon base, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, that's okay.
The claw. I think it also wants us thinking about Chibnall. I think that's another 42 connection. Like, to take us from Chris Chibnall's first episode to a story that inspired Timeless Children.
His signature move, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Plus, I think it's Schuette's facial hair. Like, now we know it is canon that Schuette is not the first Doctor with a mustache.
That's true. My connection to 42 was, it's alive!
Yes!
The sun creature there is shockingly alive, and there's a bit of your it's alive moment, several of them in this, so good times.
Very, very much so. Yes, both are, you're absolutely right, both are Frankenstein homages, or Bride of Frankenstein homages, or whatever.
I didn't mention this in the previously earlier, but we did the Reign of Terror recently, which has a lot of talk of beheadings. And there is a beheading, in fact, in the first scene of the Reign of Morbius with that unfortunate mutt, which again,
with
that's another
mutt.
Thing.
Yeah.
A mutt from Solas, I guess.
And
the Doctor even calls it a mutt. I mean, it's called a mutt by several characters, but it's kind of like this weird thing where everyone vaguely remembers the mutants.
Yes.
But doesn't really know what it was about because the mutts were supposed to be these transitional entities or something.
That's right.
These creatures that would eventually turn the Solosians, a lot of Solons, Solas,
whatever the hell they were.
But they would turn them eventually into these sort of super beings. And then there was a cycle there, and the mutts, they weren't really, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of lack of clarity in the mutants and how much the mutts were actually that stage, or if they were sort of degenerated by whatever the Marshall was doing. But
I do apologize to all mutt listeners out there. But yes, the randomizer has now taken us to all mutt episodes, right? We have a mutt bingo.
Yeah, pretty much. Because we did the Frontier in Space where they appear just as an illusion. But I think those are the only three appearances. But only the last thing I'll just say about it is that wasn't mutt a slur? Like, wasn't it sort of an epithet that they were using about them? And now the Sisterhood and the Doctor are using it. It's like, again, a little bit icky. It doesn't ruin anything, but it is like, oh, it's just.
Yeah, we need one of those. We need one of those sensitivity warnings before that episode, just at the start of things. Yeah. Well, I'll say one more thing. There's the connection to the moon base of basically a Sarah cocktail, to follow on from the Polly cocktail. Like, it's a moment in the chemistry lab, you know, basically defeats. So,
hydrogen.
Cyanogen, yes.
Cyanide, that's what
hydrogen it is. Cyanide, aka prussic acid. I mean, could the show, like and then they call it HCN as well. Like, could the show be any clearer about, hey, kids, go out and get some hydrogen cyanide? Like, it's mentioned so many times.
You know, they don't even have, like, a little fan or something. You think the Doctor Who would pull that out? Because, like, they just put it there in the vent, but they're not protected. In fact, they're, like, right up next to it. Like, they should be, like, on the other side of the room.
Yes. Remember, kids, when you kill someone upstairs with your hydrogen cyanide, remember to wear masks so you don't get any blowback. PSA, well, the more you know.
Well, at least you'd have some today. All right.
But yes, ultimately, I'm going to say, just to close the loop
to move on.
The randomizer has noted how much we talk about headcanon, and it just wanted to give us the ultimate pun. Oh, this is the ultimate.
All right, all right. Don't lose your head, folks. We're getting to the second question, and that is, of course, what if the evil plot had succeeded? All right, so I think you have to imagine then that Morbius, it's not that he wins the mind-bending contest, he just doesn't go for it, because honestly, it's such a blunder. Because you have total physical superiority over the Doctor and Sarah, why put yourself, like, it's just dumb. Why put yourself in a place where you might actually lose? And it's his arrogance, obviously, that leads him to do it. But if he somehow has a second of like, oh, I need to be smart here, and he doesn't go for it, then he can just overpower the Doctor and Sarah. Now, I like to think, though, rather than just the boring thing that he kills them and wins and conquers the galaxy or whatever, we still have the Sisterhood attacking. So before he can kill the Doctor and Sarah, they attack, and instead he takes them hostage and uses them as leverage to flee Karn. And then he, maybe they escape at the last minute. But what the point is, this is all going to kick off like a Morbius arc, as opposed to this whole story. And so the Doctor needs to go back to Gallifrey. He's got to marshal forces. Maybe this is the better reason why he can't have Sarah travel with him anymore, because he has to essentially fight a time war against Morbius here in the Fourth Doctor era, because you have to assume Morbius is being at least a bit truthful that millions of people are going to rise up because, hey, look, the evil strongman's back. He's obviously sort of a Hitler figure in Time Lord history, and the big evil people are studied by evil, as they say, when you study something like Morbius. So it's like he's going to have followers, and then there's this whole winner take all battle for the cosmos, man. It's going to be huge.
I love it. Big Finish, call us. I'm signing up for that series. Obviously, Morbius has not been used, so this is a real sort of a whole Doctor Who Unbound thing you could do. I'm going to say, if you consider the evil plot is not Morbius's but Solon's, like there's no way that Morbius can go on in that body, because the Sisterhood will just destroy it. And also, we know that brain casing has all these side effects, and like Morbius is just doomed once he's in that brain case already, right? So the only way I think this can succeed is if Solon successfully captures the Doctor and puts the brain of Morbius in the Doctor's head like he intended. And then perhaps Morbius is not so crazy, and he does know that to get out of here, he's going to have to pretend to be the Doctor.
But wait a minute, is this Tom Baker's head on that body, or is it?
No. I think that you also have to surmise that Morbius kind of, that Solon kind of says, oh, screw that Frankenstein's monster thing. Like, no, better thing is just stick it in Tom Baker's body.
Oh, he's okay.
Which I think, again, wonderful spin-off series, and also wonderful tie-in to A Deadly Assassin that you could have just going forward. The Doctor is actually Morbius. And you're following this, you're wondering when it's going to happen. And it all leads up to this big showdown on Gallifrey, where the Doctor actually does assassinate the Lord President. But then the Master comes along to save the Time Lords, and you've got a whole different Deadly Assassin unfurls from that point forward.
Then the Master kind of becomes the Doctor, right? You know what I mean? Because Morbius is even worse. And so it's sort of the scales get balanced.
The Time Lords have to give the Master a whole series of new regenerations like they do for the Doctor.
Complete new life cycle, yeah.
Yeah. And they give it to him instead of, and so he becomes, the show becomes Master Who.
Amazing. Wow. We just came up with two epic Unbound series right here based on the brain of Morbius. That is some serious headcanon.
That's right.
Sorry, the pud was irresistible. time to move on.
Yes, we do have magnificent heads here on Pulled
Up. Third question. Which is, of course, where is the Clara Splinter? Clara Oswald, of course, splintered in time at the end of The Name of the Doctor. She's somewhere in every single Doctor Who story. Where is she in the brain of Morbius?
Well, she's got to be a sister.
Yeah.
I think that, that's the obvious one here. She's not going to be in danger of being, you know, having her cranium opened by Solon. As one of the sisterhood, but I think that she's got to be the one who kind of mutes the flame for a bit.
She puts some soot in there.
She's just like, you know, and she kind of tells the old fuddy-duddy leader matron, as the doctor calls it, which I love that he uses the term matron. Mm-hmm. Again, probably hasn't aged well, but definitely of an era of like boarding schools and the NHS. everyone would understand matron. But anyway, yeah, so Sarah, I'm just going to call her matron. Sarah pulls the wall over. Clara, the sister, Clara, pulls the wall over matron's eyes. And that's why it's actually so easy for the doctor to come along. But it's an important animator for the plot, for them to think that the fire is dying.
Well, that's pretty good. I had her also as a sister, mm-hmm. but filling in the blank of where does Sarah get that pink cloak, which they never show. You know, the capes, they're all wearing capes, and then Sarah just sort of dresses up as one. It's like, wait, where did she get that? In fact, this is inspired by my daughter who asked that very question. Where'd she get that outfit? So I think she's one of these sisterhoods, and they're like, hey, we got to go to the sacred flame. There's another ritual. And she just came back from a run, and she's like, you know what? Like, I've got a shower. I'll get there later, but you start without me. Okay. And then she's showering and she's got her cloak outside the shower, and Clara's just, okay, grab this and see what I can do. And there it is.
I love it. That makes so much sense. And now I sort of want to see a video of the Brain of Morbius edited together to the sound of Lizzo's tune Pink from the movie Barbie. because Sarah is fabulous in pink in this. And yeah, I love that idea that it was actually Sister Clara's costume that allowed the Doctor to escape.
All right, Pull to Open fans, your remix orders are clear. Go and do that. In the meantime, we will proceed to the final question, the ultimate question, the only question that matters for the brain of Morbius. What did we think of this story? The Pull to Open rating system has 6 ratings. There's the Dalek, which we give to a good episode of Doctor Who. The Ogron, which we give to an irredeemably bad episode of Doctor Who. The Professor Hater, which we give to a not-so-good episode, but hey, at least they tried something. The Viscount Banger, which we reserve for the best of the best. A Fixed Point in Time, which is a story beyond rating, usually for reasons of nostalgia. Or the Lady Cassandra, which is a paper-thin plot, but hey, at least it looks good, especially with a little moisturizing. All right.
Well, first of all, just to backtrack to last week's final question, I'm so bummed, and I'd like to apologize to the spirit of Douglas Adams that when you said the final question, the ultimate question, I didn't say 42.
You don't get a do-over. You don't get a second throw, scare us. Anyway.
Yes, time can be rewritten. Story. But for this one, I'm going to, this may be controversial because I know that this is a beloved story, but I'm sorry to say that for me, it is just a Dalek.
Okay.
It's a good story. But it just, there are too many elements that kind of drag it down to Dalek level for me. It's a very solid Dalek, but it's, you know, it's Kondo, you know, the lazy Igor likeness of that. It's also the Deus Ex Machina of the Mindbender game, which is just sort of like, what? Where? This thing that's just been hanging out in the lat? Like, why was it even there? What is going on? Why wasn't this mentioned? Like, at least throw in a mention of Time Lord wrestling at the beginning or something.
Well, I think it's kind of okay that there's a mind analysis thing. Yeah, they should have mentioned it, but it's like he's doing brain stuff. He has the ability to talk to a brain. So there's a
he's
lot
doing
of
brain stuff. Obviously, yeah. Mind wrestling.
I mean, it, you know, it's not too much of a stretch in sci-fi world. So I think that's fine. And it's one of the reasons I'm not docking really points, because I'm going all the way. This is a Viscount banger for me. I had a delightful time watching this. I think mostly because of Philip Madoc. I was just loving every second he was on screen and just loving Baker's interaction with him. I thought it was super fun. And when Morbius comes out at the end, it's such a great payoff. And even though I think there's not nearly enough of that, if there's a thing I would say doesn't quite work. But once he's fully complete and you just sort of hear his first word is like cyanide, but because he was such a mindless brute before, the fact that he's even speaking, you know, now as this thing, I mean, he started stuck as the brain before, but he's just like, okay, now he can, you're just ready for like this showdown with the doctor, which again happens a little too quickly, but there's a lot of clever dialogue. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I just super loved it. So it's a banger for me. It's a Viscount banger.
All right. It is a monstrous hybrid of a Viscount banger and a Dalek, a thing that just shouldn't live and should be driven off cliff edges by the Sisterhood carrying torches. No. It's a lovely hybrid. We love it. Stick around forever, Brain and Morbius, who are really cool.
Don't forget to vote.
Yes.
You now get your voice to tell us whether we're wrong, whether we're right, whether this is a banger, a Dalek, a professor hater, a Lady Cassandra. It could be an Ogron to you. Who knows? But you need to say so in our polling feature on Spotify. Vote now, vote often, and we will report on the results in a future podcast. But for now,
that's right. And let me, just before we step back into our TARDIS, I'd just like to add one thing, a personal note, that there is another reason why the randomizer took us here. I think it's because in my Mashable life, we're recording this at the beginning of March. I'm about to start March Mindfulness, which, as you may remember, Pete, is my whole series on meditation technology. But it also has this game at the center of it, this mind-bending game using the Muse headset. It's basically a meditation off. And I think that, I'm thinking about how to redesign it this year. It happens at the end of the month. I'm going to be doing it at GDC, at the Games Developers Conference in San Francisco. So if anyone's listening who's going to be at GDC, come find me there. We will have a mind-bending game. And maybe we will include aspects inspired by Brain of Morbius. And we'll go back through your past lives. So, look out for that.
As long as you can keep it all straight in your head. Speaking of things you should keep in your mind, everyone, you should go check out our website at pulltoopen.net and subscribe to our newsletter and get full written notes on this episode. There's always a few things we don't get to in our commentary, so there's extra bonus content. You can also support us at Patreon at patreon.com/pulltoopen. If for whatever reason you're not on YouTube and don't want to become a true companion of the podcast. And
You do. Spoiler alert, you do.
Follow us on the socials at pulltoopen or pulltoopen63. And now you can get back into our TARDIS and activate the randomizer to find out where we're going next.
All right, the randomizer, two components. Pete has the codex in front of him. That's the list of all Doctor Who stories in sequential order, including all the stories that we still have yet to visit. Pete, what's the magic number?
Now that I have knocked off Brain of Morbius, we are at 190.
190. You've knocked off the Brain of Morbius, and there's green goo all over the floor. But I enter that 190 into random.org, which is the other part of the randomizer, the executor. It uses atmospheric noise and the number of mutt ships in the atmosphere to generate a random number, not algorithmic randomness, because as it doesn't even take a Professor Solon to tell you that the algorithmic randomness is rubbish and you can't really use it, and it's kind of a Frankenstein's monster of randomness. So
okay, we'll take
before
it.
We activate this thing, we like to issue some challenges, the randomizer. Pete, what do you want to see next?
Well, it's funny, we had a long discussion about canon and what is the orthodox view in changing canon? What are the rules to that, if any? And I want to explore that even more. So why don't we go to another episode that messes with canon, messes with your expectations on how the Doctor Who universe works? and affects them a little bit.
So I love that. That is such a great thing, and it's hard to, I mean, that, and this is one of the great things about Brain Morbius, right? You wouldn't necessarily expect it to be a story that like upends all the canon because it just comes in at the end. And Doctor Who kind of does that. There are little bits and tweaks here and there, a suggestion of this or that. So I like your chances of getting something. I'm going to say, you know, I'm going to fully conquer my childhood fear of brains and brains in jars and brains being removed from heads and Spock's brain and all of that. I'm going to say, bring us more brains.
Oh, wow.
I want to see another exposed brain somewhere in the next story.
Okay. I can think of a few, but I think, again, Keys of Marinus, here we come, man. This is
oh, boy. Great.
But let's instead cut right to the countdown. Mm-hmm. And then we'll
I'll hit the generator button.
Here we go. 4, 3, 2, 1.
Fantastic.
63. Oh, we're still in old
not
Who.
Keys of Marinus. It is. Oh, the Keeper of Trakan.
Oh, shoot. Wow. We were just talking about the Master.
Speaking of bad guys body swapping.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And Baker and the Deadly Assassin and wow.
Yep. Messing with goodness. Canon a little bit, perhaps.
We're gonna have a ruined Master bingo.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And it's messing with regeneration canon. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, a little bit.
Wow.
All right, folks.
Okay.
Well, this has been Pull to Open. It is a podcast. What are you doing with podcasts? Well, you're not putting them in your head just yet.
Well, you are.
You kind of are. I mean, with your headphones. And anyway, you follow podcasts. That's what you do. You subscribe and you also recommend them to a friend. All of those things are great things to do. We, of course, appreciate anyone who gives a review in the Apple Podcast app or wherever you find podcasts. And thank you very much, Martin West, for our music. We will see you next time.
Yes, and here's the bit at the end where I say very fast that side effects of inserting this podcast in your head may include severe pain, seizures, perhaps even madness. Talk to your doctor for more details.
And an unrelenting love of the show Doctor Who.
Indeed.
One. Folks, come celebrate that love in your head and in your hearts next time out when we visit the Trakan Union and tap into the source.
That's right. We'll see you with Nyssa.